I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
This is episode 144 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. We're covering lots of ground this week. We start by reviewing a couple of quite important new or newish performance cars. And then we try and do something we don't do very often on this podcast. We try and have a grown-up discussion. We talk about EVs and the reality of living with an EV and who they do suit, who they don't suit. It's an important discussion. So we get onto that. We start by talking about the M4 CSL and the Honda Civic Type R. Enjoy the episode. Plenty to get through this week, Andrew, because we're talking about a couple of cars, important new-ish performance cars that we've been driving.
Yeah.
And also, we're going to try and be adults a little bit later on in this episode and have what we hope...
Grown-ups.
It's a grown-up discussion.
It's quite frightening, isn't it?
About electric cars. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't come naturally to us, but we'll give it a go. So I saw from your Twitter over the weekend, you've been knocking about in the BMW M4 CSL.
Yes.
It looks like you took it on your test route that you take all test cars.
Yep.
I haven't driven this car yet. I'm hoping to have a go in it this week, but...
Yeah.
It's one of those cars from BMW that I find it quite easy to be a bit cynical about.
Yeah.
Because it's called CSL. It's actually more than 1,700 kilos, which
yes.
is not exactly L, is it? L for lightweight.
No.
But this is 2023, and there are now 3-ton passenger cars on the road. I don't love the way it looks, and I've driven a few similarly configured high-performance BMW M cars recently that I haven't really got along with. However, there are other, you know, I'm thinking the M5 CS, which is a triumph. So I'm trying to figure out where it sits, the CSL sits. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so also, you know, we have to remember sort of the last really nutty M4, which was the GTS.
Yeah.
Which was one of the worst BMWs I've ever driven.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible thing. So actually, if I'm honest with you, for all the reasons you stated, I came to this car with my sort of level of expectation under fairly close control. Also, what I was terrified about was these things come on Cup 2 R's as standard.
Yeah, Cup 2 R's?
Cup 2 R's. So this is Michelin's ultimate track day tyre. And where I am at the moment, it is very cold and very wet.
Mm.
And I thought, if this thing turns up on that, I mean, I'm going to... basically learn more about myself and my instinct of survival than I'm going to know anything about the car. Anyway, it didn't. Thankfully, there's the option tyre is a Michelin Pilot 4S. So it turned up on sensible tyres, which is great. So when was it? We're recording this on Monday. So yesterday morning, as I always do, Sunday morning, you know, up before the dawn, out in the car. I mean, it was still fairly... So if you hear me sniffing and sneezing my way through this podcast, there's a reason for that, which is that I've got a cold, so apologies in advance. But back to the CSL. still pretty suboptimal conditions, still very cold, still very wet, and still pretty stiff car. And it doesn't matter what tyres you've got, you know, as I'm sure lots of people know, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, Alpines perform so beautifully well in wet weather conditions is not just that they're light, it's because they're soft as well. And you need that, you need that suspension movement, you know, to be able to cut through the crap and, you know, and get the traction and everything else. And the M4 CSL hasn't. So I liked it much more than I thought I was going to. I really did. I thought it was just going to be one of these things where you just sort of bang about and have no ride quality and ping off every bump and slip and slither and slide its way around the place in a not particularly engaging or rewarding way. And I would end up getting cheesed off with it and taking the easy route home. I didn't. I really, given the conditions, and it would be, you know, you get such a different driving experience in a car like that, wouldn't you, if you drove it on a warm, dry road. It'd be completely different. So, you know, bearing in mind that this was very, very far from its, you know, preferred environment, it was pretty good. So for a start, it rides.
Interesting.
I mean, not brilliantly, but well enough, which the M4 GTS didn't. The M4 GTS was one of the worst riding cars I've ever driven. And that's not me being sort of middle-aged and wanting my comfort. It's actually about the dynamic driving experience. Because if you're being kicked about inside the car, if it is hopping and skipping and jumping off everything that it hits, that's a poor handling car, and it gets in the way of your driving enjoyment. And the M4 CSL is not like that. It's good enough. I could quite see myself, you know, doing a big trip out to the Nürburgring, and it wouldn't be a pain at all doing that. And so I appreciated that. There's so much configurability on it. You know, you can configure not just the dampers, but the transmission and the steering and the brakes. You know, the feel of everything is configurable. And what, on one hand, you know, we always go on, don't we, about how important it is to be able to set the car up to the way you want it to be. On the other hand, I'm thinking this is all just electronics doing this. This is all software maps. This isn't sort of, you know, driver to car to road mechanical linkages. And so there is this sort of artificiality about it too. And although, you know, it is, you could tell instantly every change you make, and they are, and they do feel like real changes. It does feel a little bit arcade-ish as a result. But the engine, what is it, 540 horsepower from that 3-litre straight six? Absolutely mega. So much torque. So drivable. It's not all sort of packed up the top end. Very good throttle response. On quicker roads, it's really, really good. The damping is superb. It's lovely and poised. It's a nice car to drive like that. It has a couple of drawbacks. In slower corners, you cannot escape the weight. This is a car that weighs more than an A110. You know, I happen to have it. I'm knocking about an A110 at the moment. And you get in a car like that, which is, you know, so sporting, but it weighs half a ton. It weighs an entire Caterham. You know, you could park my Caterham and the Alpine next to each other on the same set of scales, and they still come out as less than one M4 CSL. And it's not so much of a problem in the quicker stuff, but in the slower cars, you do notice that heft. I think its biggest drawback is the slusher. 8-speed automatic gearbox.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, guys.
CSL, it just seems wrong, doesn't it? An 8-speed slusher in a CSL.
It does. Well, there's a reason for it seems wrong. It's wrong. It's as good as an 8-speed slusher can get, but it's not that bang, 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 which you want. You know, let alone a manual. So, yeah, so it's a... Well, they're making 1,000, aren't they? And 100 are coming to the UK and they're all gone. So it's sort of slightly academic. I think what it is quite interesting about this car, and I'm sure they didn't plan it this way, but there is a sort of space has opened up for it because the 911 GT3 has gone all hardcore and has absolutely sacrificed, for want of a less excruciating word, roadability for track poise. The M4 CSL actually sort of gets into that space where the GT3 one. Now, it's not as good a car as a GT3. If you think of a 991 Gen 2 GT3 Touring, you know, even without a manual gearbox, you know, the M4 CSL is not as good a car as that. But it's that kind of car. It is a, I mean, you could daily drive it. You know, it's only got two seats, which, you know, you have to get your head around. But it's a perfectly practical, it's got all the stuff you want. It's got seat heaters and cruise control and decent, now all the stuff that, you know, manufacturers tend to sort of rip out of these cars and then put back as no cost options because they want to keep the weight down. It's all there. So it's perfectly civilized, big boot. I really liked it. And if that is damning with faint praise, that's probably fair enough. Because what this isn't is some kind of, you know, landmark BMW M car. Would I yesterday morning have had, on the same tyres, more fun in an M2 comp? Probably. In a manual M2 comp? Definitely. And this is, you know, a £128,000 car. So, yeah. I mean, good, but not great. And, you know, better than I expected it to be, which is positive. Not as good as I hoped it might be. There you go.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's no question that BMW M, they can still do it. You know, you drive an M2 Comp or an M2 CS or an M5 CS, and they are landmark cars for BMW M. They are superb. They're so much fun to drive, but also technically so brilliant. Yeah. And it does sound as though the M4 CSL is kind of partway towards that, but doesn't, for whatever reason, take that next step. Maybe it is the gearbox, maybe it is the weight. But yeah, curious thing. So I've been driving another, what I think is quite a significant new performance car, the new FL5 Honda Civic Type R.
Are you on top of your FLs and EKs and...
Only as of last week.
Yeah.
Just because they had them all there and I... Yeah, so how does it go? So the ones
which is the first one? Was the first one the EK9?
No, the... Oh, yes, it was, but it wasn't available in the UK, that one.
Yeah.
So the first...
That was the screamer, wasn't it?
That was the ridiculous... Yeah. I know Jethro Bovingdon will actually laugh at this torque output figure. It's amazing. A torque figure can be funny because it does deliver 118 pounds.
Let me guess where it is, where it's delivered.
Go on then.
So it's going to rotate a bit. I'm going to go 7.1.
I don't know if it's exactly, it's beyond six and a bit. Yeah. So yeah. It's way, way up there. And I know that whenever Jethro sees that number, he laughs. because it is, you see a figure like that and you just know how the car's going to drive, how the engine is going to perform. It's going to be, you're going to have to rev the nuts off it, which is great, you know, in a little light car. That's brilliant.
Have you, sorry, this is very patronising, but I just don't know whether you have. Have you driven one of those early VTEC cars where it changes?
Yeah. The DC2 Integra Type R.
Yeah, so that's the VTEC on those cars worked by there was a piston inside the camshaft, wasn't it? And it literally changed the cams operating on the valves. So and you could, it was like flicking a switch, and so you go whoa, 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 suddenly go bang,
yeah.
When literally a completely different cam profile with different duration and different lift would suddenly take over. And at 5,500 revs, whenever this thing cut in, you just basically, you find yourself driving a different car to the one you were driving half a second ago. It was brilliant.
In the right kind of car, it is fantastic, isn't it? It's really
brilliant.
Good fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the following two Civics still had really revvy NA engines. You know, put me on the spot now. EP3 was the first that was available in the UK and built in the UK. And then FN2.
You lost me already.
FK2, I think.
It's like it's like BMWs. If it begins with an E, I can cope.
Yeah, but yeah, the
moment BMW start talking about F's and G numbers, I just can't cope with them at all.
Yeah, I've lost them there. I've lost them. So I will forget those Civic Type R numbers. I may even have got those wrong. Forgive me if I did. But anyway, the point being, we're now on FL5. This car's no longer built in the UK, so it's the first since the EP3. Several generations ago, that's not UK built.
Is that one reason why it's so ridiculously expensive?
It's one reason, but actually it's supply that's the problem. So it is now 47 grand basic.
47 for a Honda Civic.
There's an option called Carbon Pack. You can guess what that gives you, just bits of carbon. And that takes it over £50,000.
So I know we spend our life talking about A110s on this podcast, but that's an A110 or a Honda Civic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a Cayman. Bananas.
It's a Cayman a Honda Civic.
It is bananas how these cars have become so expensive. The thing is, Honda UK has priced it there because it's going to shift every single one it can. And supply is going to be so choked that people will be flipping these cars, I'm sure. I think we'll see them go for, over the next few months, I think we'll see them advertise.
Where's the world come to where people are flipping Honda Civics?
I think 60K.
Goodness.
Whether or not it'll last, I don't know, but I think we'll see it.
Sorry, I'm going to go completely off down a tangent yet, but I just haven't seen one. Have you yet seen a GR86 for sale in the UK? I haven't. But I've been really interested. So, yeah, somebody pays 30 grand for one of those. What could you flip it for?
Yeah. They'll be flipped.
Massively.
No question. No, I saw one in the UK for the first time on this event, actually, as a press car. Lovely looking little thing.
Yeah.
They'll get flipped. I haven't seen one for sale yet, but they're coming, aren't they? The Civic Type R deliveries begin, I think it's next month. So keep your eye on the classifieds. They'll be up there.
Yeah.
But the issue with this car, from a supply point of view, is that, well, there are the usual semiconductor things that are causing so many troubles across the industry. But the big issue is emissions regulations. So Honda UK, they have to balance their fleet carbon average across all their cars.
Do they do that in the UK?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Honda UK has to do this. So for every relatively high emitting Civic Type R they sell in the UK, they have to sell X number of Honda E's, you know, electric Honda E's and little Jazzes and so on that are very low emitting. And it just means that they have to choke supply. They have to limit supply. Otherwise, they face massive fines. And it becomes more difficult in 2024 when they can no longer offset their high-emitting combustion cars against EVs in the same way that they can now. So they will only be able to offset petrol and diesel cars against other petrol and diesel cars. So supply is only going to become more and more difficult. And that's why they're able to charge 47 grand for it, because...
And that's why they'll sell every one of them.
They'll sell them all.
Is there a limit to the number they're bringing? Have they said? They've said there's an allocation, haven't they?
It's hundreds per year.
Yeah.
And actually, there was this extraordinary slide in Honda's presentation ahead of the launch event. And it showed the EP3 and the one that followed, I think that's FN2. Certainly the EP3 sold as many as 5,000 plus a year in the UK.
Goodness.
Not every year. I think it peaked over 5,000 one or 2 years, but it was consistently 4,000 a year. And now they're looking at a few hundred a year.
Yeah.
And it's partly because the market has changed and the likes of Audi, BMW, Mercedes have come in with their own very powerful... Are they even hot hatches? I don't know. It's a different discussion, but, you know, comparable cars.
Yeah.
But also, those earlier Civics, they were less than 20 grand. Less than 20 grand. This one, if you tick that carbon box, is a 50 grand car. So inevitably, volumes are lower. And so they're going to shift every single one that they can. There aren't going to be many of them. They will be flipped, I'm sure. So it's a very different proposition to the Civic Type R's that we've had before. and this FL5 follows the FK8, which I thought was a titan among hot hatches. I thought it was a fantastic car.
It was the greatest hot hatch. It was certainly, I mean, I think you could possibly argue the toss in its generation between that and the Mark 7.5, either the GTI or the Golf R, but actually as a thing just to drive, that was the greatest hot hatch of modern times.
Yeah, absolutely superb. And it was, for me, held back by 2 points. It didn't have a customizable driving mode, which sounds like a boring adenoidal thing to say, but it meant that in comfort mode, you had this lovely ride quality, lovely plush fluid suspension. And our terrible B roads, it worked beautifully. It just soaked up the road.
Yeah.
And you look at this thing, it looks so extreme. You just think, well, it's going to ride like a skateboard. But it didn't. The trouble is, in that comfort mode, the engine is totally flat. Or rather, the engine mapping is totally flat.
Yeah.
And so you lose the excitement of the engine, which is a pity because it's such a great motor. And so, fine, you turn it into sport or plus R mode. And the engine comes alive again, but then the suspension goes rock hard and you lose that lovely...
Have you ever got into a car in the UK which does let you choose and not gone for comfort suspension and sport powertrain?
No, you just do it all the time.
You just do it automatically, don't you? It is just the setup.
Yeah, and when you've got a customer a mode where you can save your preferred setup, it's always that.
Of course.
It's always engine up, suspension down, and away you go.
Off you go.
It might be a unique, you know, unique to the UK because our roads really are pretty awful.
I think most places I go, I just do that automatically. And yeah, some places where the roads are faster and smoother, it works less well. But even so, you're not on a racetrack here. You're always going to have undulations. You're going to have a bit of body movement, and you just, you know, you just don't want it to be tied down and, you know, uncomfortable and it springs. Anyway, did you like it? Was it any good?
So, quickly on the FK8, so, because it didn't have the customizable driving mode, it was always compromised. Whichever mode you chose, something was compromised, engine or suspension. And then there's the way the car looked. It's a totally subjective point, but I couldn't get on with the way that car looked. It, you know, outlandish styling. I get some people quite like that about it, but I honestly couldn't have it as my car because of the way it looked. Maybe that's shallow,
really?
But...
So you would stop, even if it was, so I'm not trying to put words in your mouth here, but even if there were, even if it, you know, even if it drove like, I don't know, a Cayman GT4, would looks alone would stop you having it? I don't think it would ever stop me because I don't think I care enough. You know, I'm the least fashion conscious person you'll ever meet. And also, I take the view that actually the only person who really matters is me. And I spend the time on the inside looking out.
So I think I'm not worried about brand or image. You know, that's why I had to mention it again. That's why I had an Alpine. You know, if I wanted to show off, I'd have had the Porsche, but I literally don't care about that stuff. So I was quite happy with the Alpine. But I think I would lose something in spotting it from my living room window and just thinking, ooh, that's a bit of a mess.
Yeah, not fair enough.
I think it probably would bother me. Maybe if I had it in black, which is the best colour for it, I could live with it. But I don't know. I certainly it would give me reason to hesitate. And then you look at this new FL5. It has the customizable driving mode. Well done. That was probably very straightforward incorporating that. It also looks, in my view, so much better. It's a subtler, cleaner, simpler design. Way, way more handsome, in my view. So it fixes that problem. And it fixes the driving mode issue. And so you think, yippee, here we go. It's going to be superb. And actually, it is superb. It's very, very good. It's still got that superb engine and that peerless manual gear shift. It's actually even better now. The engine feels livelier than it ever did before. It's got a bit more power. It's a bloody fast thing. It's still got fantastic seating position, great seats. The interior is a bit smarter now. But they've made it a more narrow-minded car, a more singular, focused car. Doesn't ride like the previous one at all. It's actually quite different in that regard. So you no longer have that wonderful, plush, supple feel on our challenging roads. That's gone. And it's not terrible, but it's more like other hot hatches, you know, just knocking you about, sort of jiggling all over the place. And even in normal driving, the duality of the old car, which was freakishly comfortable just as an everyday family car, it's gone.
So is it... what am I trying to say? Is it the same sort of difference that, albeit a completely different part of the market, we found between the 991 and the 992 GT3s?
Possibly. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, it's kind of similar. It is kind of similar. It doesn't ruin it, and it's not unbearable as an everyday car at all, but you lose that point of distinction. You lose that quality. You know, it's gone. And what they've done is they've just built a more serious, more focused, more less broadly defined car.
Yeah, as you know, they've built with the GT3.
Yeah, they've built a better track car.
Yeah.
although we drove it on track. The launch event was down in Hampshire, and we were on Thruxton, a slippery, greasy Thruxton, which is a frightening place at the best of times. And we started in the FK8, just as it's a curious decision on the part of Honda UK, I guess, as a refresher or something. Actually, all it did in those conditions was serve to remind me that the FK8 was a fantastic car and actually preferable to the new one. You know, when the track is slippery, you still want a degree of compliance.
Yeah.
And the old one steers better as well. The new one doesn't have the same crispness in the steering.
The FK8, because obviously you couldn't have the FK8 in the mode you wanted, particularly in those sorts of conditions. So you would have had to have had that in sport. So even with the sport suspension, was it more compliant than the new one? Was it FL5 in its comfort setting?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, the new one, I'm sure on a dry track, it will, once the weather improves, it will go to the Nürburgring and it will break the production car front-wheel drive lap record. It's going to. I've no doubt about that at all. It's a more serious car. And when you're really up it on a dry track, I'm sure the changes they've made pay dividends. And I'm sure it's way quicker. But I see this happening now. You know, it was the same with the last Golf R, the 20 years that I drove recently.
Yeah.
A more narrow-minded, more focused car. And I just, it's as though these feel like the end of days for engineers. And they're just going, sod it. Let's just build the most fearsome, the fastest, the meanest cars that we can. Which is great, you know. They are building phenomenal, they're building the fastest hot hatches around a circuit that we've ever seen. But you inevitably lose something on the road, particularly our roads.
Which is where you use these cars.
It's where you use them.
Is there a really nutty OE tyre they could bolt onto it to go and do a Nürburgring tyre?
There wasn't actually anyone there who would know that. There weren't any engineers or experts there, so I don't know that. But it comes on a PS4S.
Okay, so they'll put a Cup 2R on it, won't they?
They might well do, yeah, and they'll go and do some storming lap time. And it'll be, you know, if you're a racing driver on a dry track, it'll be fantastic. I've no doubt about that. But you lose something on the road, and I think that's such a pity because it seems like it's actually easier. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me like it would be easier to create a focused car that is really optimized for dry weather, for smooth roads, for racetracks. It's harder to build something that works beautifully on a wet, bumpy British B road and is brilliant on track, which the FK8 was. So actually the new car, it's, you know, in its element, it's a fantastic thing. But the point is, it's actually no better overall than the previous one, even though it looks so much better, even though it has that individual driving mode. So I think given the choice, I'd actually rather drive the previous one, even though I dislike the way it looks so much. And then you have to factor in the price difference. It's 15 grand more expensive than Honda UK was asking for the previous car a year and a half ago.
It's a lot, isn't it? It's an entire car more.
Yeah. 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 So it's a huge step up. But, you know, in its element, I'm sure it's absolutely fantastic to drive, but I happen to prefer the previous one.
Just before we get on to EVs, can you lend me £43,000?
What do you want to buy?
So there's a chap who I know called Simon Lane, and he's he's an engineer up at Lotus, and he has a beautiful mustard yellow Lotus Esprit GT3 1998 car. Now the GT3. If anybody is struggling to remember which particular Esprit I'm talking about, because let's face it, there have been so many, was the sort of the club sport GT3. So it had a 2-litre engine rather than a 2.2. It was never very fast, but it was super light. And when I drove it back in period, goodness me, 25 years ago, I just thought, this is what I want an Esprit to be. And I've other than a Sport 300, which are bazillions, that's the Esprit I want. And I just happen to know this particular car and this particular owner, and I know how well looked after it would be. And I spent the weekend thinking about nothing else and sort of trying to do man maths. And also trying to work out what the hell I'd do with it.
Really?
Because what am I going to do with a GT3 Esprit? It doesn't fit my life at all. It'll be like all those other really nice cars that I've owned over time, which, you know, whose purpose in my life becomes just to make me feel guilty about not driving them.
Yeah.
And I have this sort of self-destruct button within me, and my eye will suddenly be caught by something, and I just think, I've got to do it. I've got to do it. Because it's not just a GT3. It's a GT3 from the right place, with the right owner, with the right provenance. And it also, I shouldn't say this, because I'm not going to be able to buy it. I can't afford to buy it, and I haven't got the money, and I don't know what to do with it. But it also doesn't strike me as being desperately expensive.
Mm. And it's not going to lose any money, is it?
It's not going to lose any money. There are 13.
13?
Well, in this spec, yeah.
Bloody hell.
In the UK. 13, 1-3.
So you could have, for 50 grand, you could have that and, I don't know, a 7-8-year-old Golf, probably older, Citroen Ami. Or a, you know, an older 3 Series or something. Or you can have an FL5 Civic Type R with the carbon pack. If nothing else, it does highlight how expensive even new hot hatches have become.
Yeah. It is nuts. And I think the time will come, we'll look back at this and we'll think, really?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Staggering, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, move on.
Okay. So there's been a lot of discussion about EVs, particularly across social media, including our platforms. And I think it was kicked off, not the weekend just gone, but the one before, by an article by Giles Corran in the Times.
Yeah.
Writing about his departed Jaguar I-Pace. Scathing, because, well, just to sort of sum it up, he had this Jaguar I-Pace for a while. It was unreliable. He tried to use it as his everyday family car, going away on holiday and so on with the family, and several times it let him him down, or the charging network let him down. And it sounds like it was a disaster. He hated it, and he was explaining why the EV revolution is therefore going to hit the buffers. And he doesn't hold back. And, you know, some people have pointed out that, well, actually what he's confused is all EV ownership with one troublesome Jaguar. Of course he's going to write it that way. It's for a generalist Sunday Times audience. He's supposed to be provocative and entertaining, isn't he? So he's not going to hold back.
And he certainly manages that. I mean, he is a polemicist, but he's a bloody funny one.
Yeah, he is.
And he does make some good points.
He does.
So, as a result, well, not as a result of that, but because it is something that I have been thinking about, I just put out a tweet on the TI Twitter account. If you don't follow us, please do. Because we're going to be making more use of it, and we're just going to be using it to find out what you think about stuff.
Underscore the intercooler, or just search the intercooler, you'll find it there.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that we wanted to know, because there's just so much stuff out there, and I'm aware of this. I mean, we live in an increasingly divided society, don't we? And I'm just aware of these sort of rival factions starting to grow up between the EV evangelists and the EV skeptics. And I just wanted to know, you know, we sort of read individual articles like the one that Giles Corran wrote, and we thought, my goodness, that's terrible. And you hear stories. Someone was tweeting pictures of 40 Teslas queued up at T-Bay for whatever. I just put out a tweet saying, you know, if you don't own an EV, are you more or less likely to buy one now than you were a year ago? And if you do own an EV, are you glad with your decision? Do you bitterly regret it or whatever? And the response was amazing. Hundreds of people got back to us. And the answers were not exactly what I thought. And I just thought it was a really interesting dialogue. All we were doing were polling people who follow us on Twitter. So you know, it's hardly, you know, a rigorous exercise we did. But I would say that generally speaking, the people who had bought EVs, no, not even generally speaking, overwhelmingly speaking, the people who had bought EVs were glad that they had.
Hmm.
And there wasn't this sort of buyer's remorse going on, which I'd sort of expected. People saying, well, yeah, I did this because it seemed like the right thing to do and I thought it would fit my life, but actually the reality is the range isn't anything like people claim. You can't charge the bloody things. The charging network is broken. More and more EVs are piling onto the roads every day. Things are only getting worse. You know, give me back my Golf diesel. There was very little of that. There was an awful lot of, this has changed my life. You know, it fits my life perfectly. I've had my EV for a year now. I've been seriously delayed once. And I'm never going back. And it was really interesting. And on the other side of the debate, there were people who don't own EVs. They seem to have gone the other way. There are people who are sort of saying, well, I have thought about it, but then I've seen all this stuff about the queues, and I've heard all these stories about the network. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of them would have read Giles' story. And I just thought, no way, I'm going to hang on to my petrol stroke diesel, even maybe stroke hybrid, you know, until the government physically forces it out of my cold, dead hands. Because they look at it as some kind of nightmare. So what can we conclude from this? Well, I think the takeaway that I took from it is that, well, two things. Firstly, things are factionalizing even more.
Yeah, and massively.
Things are splitting into rival camps. And people in those camps are tribal now. That is what is happening. And when people become tribal about things, it's like whether you support the Labour Party or the Conservative Party or Manchester City or Manchester United, there is a sort of, you know, there is an element of don't blind me with the facts comes into it on all sides. And people just decide what they want and what they like, and they won't be told otherwise. So that is happening. At a more sort of basic practical level, I think that for people who have found EVs that work for them, they really work for them. But, and I think this is a massive but, I think every single person who came on and replied to that tweet and had a positive EV experience, every one of them talked about being able to charge it at home.
Yeah.
Nobody was charging it, you know, said that the charging it from lampposts was a great experience, or that they just charged it, you know, at public chargers. And I think that there are two points to be made there. The one point, the most obvious point, is, you know, you have to have off-street parking to be able to do that. So you either have to live in the middle of nowhere, and then that throws up the question of whether an EV is, you know, I live in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, I would actually like the idea, if I could, for instance, get to Heathrow and back without having to charge the car, of having an EV, because it's just a motorway all the way, and it's quiet, and, you know, and everything else, and, you know, I'm absolutely not against that idea, but I live in the middle of nowhere, and it's simply not practical. Or if you live in a town, you know, you have to be wealthy. You have to, you know, you have to be able to buy a place big enough where you can park a car and have a charger and so on and so forth. And the vast, vast, vast majority of people are not in that position. So it remains a niche product. But I think the second thing is everybody goes on about home charging, partly because it's convenient, but also, and I would say mainly, because it's so cheap. It's so affordable. And they go, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, who would ever charge it, you know, at the motorway where you get charged a bazillion pounds per kilowatt? They'd be just charged at home because it costs peanuts. Fine. For now.
Just wait.
You know, the government, I think the government raises £17 billion a year through fuel tax revenue. That all goes away. They can't afford to give that up.
No.
Everyone is charging at home. So they're going to have to find a way of taxing the electricity you put on your car at home. Now, they might do it through taxing. Well, I've got a pod point here, you know, and they'll be able to tell what comes out of that, tax that. Okay, well, people just plug them into 3-pin plugs. So how do you distinguish between the electricity that goes into your kettle and the electricity that goes into your car? And I think the only way, well, I don't know, there are many, many people who are brighter and better informed on the subject than me, but I think to me the most obvious way they're going to do that is through road pricing, and you'll just be taxed per journey. At which stage, that game's up. So I don't know whether people who have EVs now, I wouldn't say they're living in la-la land at all, but, you know, it clearly works with them now. But that does not mean that that situation is going to endure going forward. I strongly suspect that it won't, and that the cost of EV ownership, and we all know how unbelievably expensive EVs are to buy anyway, you know, I'll remind you that the basic cheapest electric Vauxhall Corsa you can buy is £31,000. Yeah?
Yeah.
a Fiesta, I think, is 17 or 18. So you're talking like half as much again for, you know, an electric hatchback. So, you know, for me, I think, well, it doesn't work for me, but I'm not important. I think generally speaking, I think it's problematic. And, you know, I don't know how you solve the problem when there are more and more EVs piling onto the road, less and less revenue coming. They're going to have to start taxing the electricity you put in your car at home. And that suddenly means that everybody who's come on and said, you know, what I love about EVs is they're just so cheap to run, they're not going to be saying that in whatever period of time it is.
That's right. This is a moment in time, isn't it? And there's no guarantee that'll last forever. Did you get any kind of sense from the people who had gone EV and were delighted, still delighted with that decision, that they had access to another car?
Yeah, lots.
Yeah.
Lots of that. Yeah. And again, you know, that's a great luxury, isn't it?
Huge luxury.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, for a so what can we conclude for this? For a certain sort of person, right now, today, an EV can be a really, really good thing. An EV can absolutely transform your personal transport solutions.
yes, well done.
But it can, because, you know, you go about your place in complete quiet and comfort. It costs you buttons and whoopee. It's great. It works. There is nothing I have seen from any of those responses that convinces me that this is the future for everybody who needs to go anywhere in a car. You know, there will be little city cars and they'll be absolutely fine because they don't need to have much range. And there'll be huge Luxo barges with massive batteries which will go and go and go forever. Because the people who own them will be able to afford to charge them wherever they park them. But for the vast majority of people, you know, so like in the middle, who just need a car to do anything. You know, whether it is to, you know, go on holiday in the Lake District or take their kids to school or, you know, or whatever you need a car to do. And that's most people, isn't it? You know, most of us just have a car and we do everything in it. And, you know, and you live in a terrace house in a street. And for the reasons of the cost of purchase, the likely future cost of running it, and this is even before we got into the residuals issues, I just don't see the answer is out there at the moment. And I'll be very interested to see where we are 5 years from now.
I feel like I'm seeing more and more cynicism around the viability of EVs for the mass of the population. I feel like I'm seeing more and more people question whether or not this really is the solution for all of us. Because as you said, clearly for certain people, fantastic.
Yeah.
But you need to be able to afford a new car and an expensive one at that. You probably need a driveway. You probably maybe need access to another car. And it might just be because things are becoming more divided. But I feel like I hear from more people saying it's going to implode in a few years. And I don't know if that's the truth or not, but there's certainly more of that kind of thinking out there. Another issue that we do have to address is that, and actually Gavin Green wrote a piece about this for us very recently. You know, a lot of these new, big, typically SUV EVs, they weigh over or only just under 3,000 kilograms. 3 tons. At three and a half, you need a different license.
I don't even know where to go with that. I mean, it is so utterly profligate.
Yeah.
It's indefensible.
Yeah.
I mean, really. I mean, you are getting, presumably, if you buy one of these 3 tons cars, the battery alone will weigh more than some cars.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a 110 kilowatt battery, I mean, that's what, half a ton? It's probably more. A Caterham in your battery, isn't it?
It's more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, 110, I'd say it's about 700 kilos, something like that.
Where is the environmental friendliness in that?
Well,
taking 3 tons of raw material out of the earth. Well, it's way more than that, isn't it? Because, you know, you lose so much of the production process. Where's the sense in that?
And then probably upgrading it in 3 years for the new model.
3 tons.
I just don't see it.
And also, and this is another story we're going to do. You've got a car that weighs 3 tons. Okay, there might not be anything coming out of its exhaust pipe. And we can argue about, you know, power generated in fossil fuel power stations. Like more and more of our power is developed by renewables, which is fine. But when we talk about emissions, people never talk about the emissions, the particulate emissions from tyres and from brakes. And if you've got a car that weighs 3 tonnes, the amount of crap that it will shed, harmful stuff, These, you know, these microscopic bits that flake off your tyres and flake off your brake. You know, that's a whole other thing coming in. And I think there is some EU legislation comes in which is going to try to control this. But there are just so many issues. And I think, you know, I just think a three ton car is just wrong. It can't need to be that heavy. And I'm sure it is that way because it is cheaper to add weight than remove it.
Yeah. It's just staggering.
And easier. And also people just don't care enough. And also, I think they probably quite like the idea of, well, I've got a 3-ton car. Well, I mean, there are armoured personnel carriers which weigh less than that. You know, imagine how good that's going to be if I hit something in it.
And the trouble is, you probably will hit it because stopping 3 tons.
Yeah, and what about the poor sod you hit?
Yeah.
So my wife got rear-ended the other day. She was on a motorway and the car in front stopped. She stopped, car behind didn't stop. Mm. Now, it was an ancient Vauxhall Sephira that went into the back of her with fairly terminal consequences to the Sephira, but you know, nobody was hurt or anything else. And, you know, it happens. And that's probably what's a 12-year-old Zafira weigh? I don't know, 1,400 kilos? Imagine that, you know, the car weighing twice as much as that came piling into the back of her. That could have been serious. That could have been quite a big accident. Mm. And people never talk about this stuff. People never think about it. I mean, and certainly if you're going to buy a car, I'm going to buy a 3-ton car. You're not going to think, oh, no, I better not do that because if I have an accident, I might hurt somebody else. What do you care?
Well, do you know what? Another story that we are going to do is take a proper, rigorous look at Euro NCAP, who award star ratings to all new cars.
Yes.
And you don't hear them talking about the weight of a car.
No, you don't. And I think that NCAP, which I think is a well-intended organisation, because what they tend to do is measure how a car performs when it's crashing.
Yes.
Yeah. What it doesn't measure is the car's ability to not have that crash in the first place. And if you believe that prevention is better than cure, then why aren't they? Mm. I mean, I've had this argument with various people, including NCAP, over the years. But I don't believe that they've ever published, for instance, brake distances.
No.
How long does it actually take? You know, if you get a 3-ton SUV, how much further does it take to stop that from a given speed than a Volkswagen Golf weighing half the weight? Now, actually, it'll have more rubber on the road. It'll have much bigger brakes. Maybe it's not much. Maybe it's nothing. I don't believe it's nothing. But why don't we know? Why aren't we told this stuff? Why don't people? Maybe we should do it. Because, you know, if you're actually, and I'm not saying that you are, we have to be careful with these things, but if you are, if it turned out that you're actually far more likely to have the accident in your 3-ton SUV, then I think people would start questioning whether a 3-ton SUV is necessarily a good thing. Mm. You know, if you buy one of these, you're more likely to crash. You're going to think twice, aren't you?
You'd hope so. You'd hope so. I think people view them, though, as safer places to be. They don't think about the likelihood of actually having an accident because you can't stop the thing. And the
but nobody is stressing that point. Nobody is making that argument.
No. Also, from X miles an hour, it might only go another 10 metres. But at the point at which a lighter car is stopped and you've got another 10 metres to go, you might still be doing 20-odd miles an hour. And if you hit someone or something or a very old car, that is fast enough in something with that much mass, that much momentum, to do serious damage. So it's a question that definitely has to be asked. I saw someone make the point the other day, actually, someone who knows about these things. He said, they're heavy, but battery electric, lithium ion, it's the best technology we've got at the moment. And perhaps it is, but we know these cars can be made lighter. It's just difficult and costly. And it might well be that what's needed actually is a much, much better charge network. So you don't need a 700 kilo battery.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's the solution.
If there was a decent charger network, if you knew that if you had an EV, that wherever you went in it, you'd be able to A, find a charger without having to queue for it, that it would work, that it would charge your car from 20 to 80% in 15 minutes. Which is enough time to, you know, grab a quick coffee and have a pee. And that you would never, you know, and that the car, and that you'd be able to do, I don't know, a genuine 180 miles, so probably 3 hours driving between each of these visits. Well, you know, that's only even going to be a problem on longer runs, and you're probably going to want to break every 3 hours. It's no problem at all.
Mm.
But we are so far from that now.
Yeah, we are. Mm. Interesting. Well, obviously this discussion will roll on and on. And, well, I look forward to having it.
Yeah, okay. And if you, dear listener, are now, you know, shouting at us because there's some vital point that we've missed, or whether you agree with us or whatever, just find a way of getting in touch with us. Any number of ways you can do it. You know, go and find that tweet. We'll be doing more stuff on this. Just tell us what you think. We are so interested in what you guys think about what we talk about, because, you know, we are the last people in the world to presume that we have the answers to anything, let alone everything. It's just a couple of blokes having a chat about what they think about stuff. And, you know, tell us what you think.
Yeah. And for me, for myself, I would like, in the relatively near future, we've got two cars, I'd like for one of them to be an EV. I want my Golf GTI / fun, usable daily car. You know, I want that to be one of our cars. And I would like our other one to be an EV, because we do drive through town a fair amount. And I think it would be good to be able to do that in an EV. Sadly, at the moment, it would be mostly Imogen's car, and the driving that she does for work, it doesn't quite suit an EV. So it's not going to happen immediately, but I can see a time fairly soon where we've got one petrol car, one EV, and that covers all bases.
And that means you're then one of the lucky ones, because that means you're a two-car family and you have off-street parking.
We can charge here. Yeah, it works
for you.
It doesn't represent everybody, does it?
No.
Good. Okay. This one will ramble on and on. We look forward to hearing what you've got to say. Listener question coming up, relating back to last week's episode. But before we do that, please go and rate and review the podcast. I say this every week, don't I? Actually, it's really important, because good reviews, good ratings mean that the likes of Spotify, the likes of Apple Podcasts push our podcast to more people. That's how we find a bigger audience. It's crucial. So please go and do that. And thank you to everybody who has.
And by finding a bigger audience means we get to do more of this.
Much, much more, yeah.
Yeah.
So this listener question this week comes from Marcus. So last week we spoke about the 10 must-see motorsport events around the world.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, Bathurst was on there. Clearly, it's not the sort of thing someone can just go and choose to go and do one weekend.
Well, you can't just toddle off to the Dakar every time you want.
So Marcus wants to have a few suggestions from us for events in the UK that are affordable to get to. So must-see motorsport events in the UK on a budget.
Okay. Well, where should we start? I'm a huge historic racing fan. Go to a clubby, just go to a little, you know, people think of historic racing, they think of the, you know, the Goodwood, you know, Revival or the Silverstone Classic, and, you know, these are amazing events. But you don't have to go to one of those to see. You can get Cadwell Park or Castle Coombe, or and just stand on the bank. You know, historic racing happens somewhere in the country almost every weekend during the season. And if you haven't gone and seen old sheds slithering around, it's just fantastic, because you can see the drivers working. The cars are so demonstrative, they move so much. If you like watching cars going sideways and being able to see real car control going on, particularly if the weather forecast is going to be bad, go stand on the bank somewhere at some little club circuit. It'll cost you nothing to get in, or no, probably nothing or hardly anything, and you will just have so much fun. And go and get a bacon sarnie from the van, and that's all you need. Go with a mate and a flask of coffee and have a great day.
So my first suggestion is actually Marcus suggested it himself, and he's absolutely right. Get across to Lyddon Hill, which is basically in Holland. It's the far end of Kent, so it is a long way. It's a long old way to get to Lyddon Hill, but go there for one of the big rallycross meets, where they've got the supercars running. Lyddon Hill is the home of rallycross. It was invented there in the 60s.
It was, wasn't it?
And it's still a fantastic spot, because it's in a bowl.
Who won the first rallycross event, and what was he in?
Vic Elford, 911.
There you go. You're good, Dad. You're good.
We should do a podcast or something. Wherever you stand at Lyddon Hill, you can basically see the whole track. And they'll have the supercars going around, which are 600 horsepower, four-wheel drive things. mega, mega quick, and they're fantastic to watch. And there'll be some old stuff knocking about as well. So Lydenhill Rallycross, that's on my list.
Where are we going to go now? Somewhere local to me, or reasonably local. Shelsley Walsh.
Yeah.
Hill climb.
Brilliant.
The oldest motorsport venue in the world still in use. Older than the Brickyard, older than Indy.
That's great.
I think they started motorsport events there in, someone's going to tell me I'm wrong, 1907, 1908, something like that. If you haven't been to a hill climb, they're fantastic things to go and watch because you get the most incredible variety of cars there. From the unbelievably rapid sort of Goulds and things like that, which accelerate faster than Formula One cars, and they are driven by nutcases, to homemade stuff, old specials, everything. People, and also it's a very easy thing to go and do yourself. People, they have these sort of run what you brung events, and you can just turn up in anything. And it takes, I think the good guys get up Shelsley Walsh in about 23 seconds now. It might take you or me slightly longer, but the real point is going is there's just the most wonderful atmosphere. And I'm not just saying, there are hill climb venues all over the country. I mentioned Shelsley Walsh and also Prescott because they're the two that are sort of most famous, and they also happen to be closest to me, so they're the ones that I go to most. But on a sunny weekend, I know having this conversation in January when it's been one of the wettest starts of the year that ever been, it sounds like a bit of a dream, but on a sunny summer's weekend, to go there with a picnic and your family or your mates and sit on the grass and just, it's like watching motorsport from another era. It's just so charming and there's so much atmosphere. It's pretty exciting too. It's just a lovely day. And if there is somebody in your life who really isn't interested in cars or motorsport, that sort of thing, and you couldn't get them to go to Silverstone for love nor money, but you, if they're ever going to enjoy any kind of, affordable viewing of motorsport, just take them to Shelsley or to Prescott. Mm. Park them on the lawn. Pack a nice picnic. And if they don't enjoy that, then give up. There's nothing they ever will.
So be it. Yeah. Do you know what I love about places like Shelsley is back in 1908 or whatever, when the hill climb discipline was created, think about those cars that were pookling up there. And the point about hill climb was to demonstrate that the cars could get to the top.
Exactly. Yes. Literally to get slowly. Up there. Well, forget the time. Literally getting up there was the achievement.
Just imagine how slowly they were going. And now there are, I don't know how powerful those Goulds are, but they are phenomenal.
600 horsepower.
Yeah,
and their tyres are made out of marmalade because they've got to heat up unbelievably rapidly and they've only got to last for 25 seconds.
Yeah,
well, they reuse them. But they're so specialised, those cars.
Mm. I just love how motorsport has evolved. It's like the Isle of Man TT. When that started on little motorbikes with no power. They probably seemed quite sensible. No one thought that they'd be averaging 133 miles an hour around that place. It's just extraordinary how these things have progressed. Okay, so the last one I'll give you is, I've actually not done this, but I'm really keen to because it looks, what did we say last week? The three tests, spectacle, atmosphere, history.
Yep.
Top Fuel dragsters at Santa Pod. For spectacle, it must be out of this world. When those things launch off the line, my God.
0 to 100 under a second.
It's just exploding off the line. They're like cannonballs, aren't they? I'm sure it's a great atmosphere. And, well, drag racing, it's as old as the motor car, isn't it? Talk about history. So, yeah.
When you go, the first time I went, I saw a Top Fuel dragster launch. What you cannot convey if you watch it on YouTube, obviously you can see it and you can hear the noise they make, but quite literally the ground shakes when they go, to the extent that the first time I went and the first time they went off the line, all the car alarms in the car park went off. You also can't convey the smell of the fuel, the nitromethanol these things run on. It gets everywhere. You taste it. So really, all your senses, taste, smell, sight, sound, the lot, you get it is total sensory overload. And if you manage to sort of stand behind one of these things and watch it disappear, it's like witchcraft. It's like watching science fiction. It is so ridiculous. Absolutely right. go get us out of the pod, go and watch the drag race.
Some good suggestions in there, I think. So Marcus, thank you for your question. Keep getting your listener questions across however you like, on Twitter, on Instagram, whatever else. And we'll end next week's episode with another.
Lovely. See ya.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.